Du hører på Fra krise til håp, en podcast av Norges sosiale forum.
We are recording this episode during the Norwegian Social Forum, where we have talked to James Midway and Daniel Werneg about the current economic situation, how the rising rates of inflation, as well as the cost of living crisis, are affecting people in the UK, but also how it's affecting people in Norway. How can we deal with this kind of situation in an environmentally friendly, just and social way? So welcome to both of you. Nice of you to take the time from your busy schedules before this globalization conference of the Norwegian Social Forum to have a chat with our podcast. We appreciate that. Our Norwegian listeners might not be so familiar with you, James. So maybe you could start by telling us a bit about yourself and the work that you do.
Sure. I'm James Midway. I'm director of a think tank in London, the Progressive Economy Forum, which is... was set up a few years ago to look at alternatives to neoliberalism and different ways of running the economy in the interests of most people, in the interests of protecting the environment. And that's what we do. We produce reports. We try and argue for certain policies and programs. And prior to that, I was economic advisor to John McDonnell, who was Jeremy Corbyn's right-hand man when he was running the Labour Party. John was the shadow chancellor, so the equivalent to the sort of opposition finance and economy spokesperson. And there I was involved with writing the economic sections for the 2017 manifesto, developing Labour's programme at the time. And prior to that, I was chief economist at a different think tank, so that's me.
Nice. Then I think we will be very good equipped with answering all these questions that we have prepared. Besides Putin's atrocity and the horrible invasion of Ukraine, the one thing that's been dominating headlines in Norway over the past year has been skyrocketing energy prices. Media has been running loads of stories about small businesses and large-scale industry not being able to pay the cost, as well as normal working people being forced to choose between eating and heating. What are the main elements that it's taking up the cost of living crisis in the UK right now?
Well, it's a very similar story. I mean, it's there are common factors to all of this. In the UK, it's probably, in fact, it is definitely worse than in Norway and other European countries, largely because if you think about what the problem on cost of living might be, one part of it is that prices, particularly of essential things like, you know, gas or food, are too high, that prices are going up very rapidly for things that people really have to buy. You can't last very long without eating. And then on the other side, wages are too low. And in Britain, we've had a decade of wages basically not barely growing. I mean, really not improving at all for most people. And this is already an unequal society. It's been made worse over that period of time. So coming into this, people are already in a bad situation. What you've seen since the start of this year, and actually predating Russia's invasion of Ukraine, but this is obviously really seriously worsened the whole thing, is that you've seen rises in the price of energy, natural gas most obviously, oil to some extent, but natural gas is the particular sort of problem that people are facing to really extraordinary levels. In Britain you had, God, I mean, the rate of increase for the price of people trying to heat their home and keep the lights on has been really quite something. In April, average energy bills, they're on a system where they go up every 6 months or they change every 6 months, was up 56%. There was an 80% increase scheduled for 1st of October, which the government has now sort of intervened to try and stop that to some extent. So it's been a really, really serious squeeze on people's living standards, that wages are nothing like going up as quickly as the prices of things that people have to buy. Food prices are also been a major part of this. Now that gas prices have come down a little bit, at least in the sort of big international markets, it's food prices that are really shooting up. And I know that Norway has had a similar problem with this.
So how has the response from the left and the unions and the social movements been? I heard that there's a day of action planned for tomorrow, and that there's this campaign by the name Can't Pay, Won't Pay, that is trying to make 1 million people to pledge not to pay their energy bills.
That's been really impressive over the last sort of 6 months or so, because of the way the energy system, the domestic energy system, is organised in Britain, it's heavily privatised. It's really deregulated. It's meant to be lots of competing companies all offering you, I mean, essentially the same gas, by the way. It really doesn't matter where you get it from, but you know, there's a market to compete for this. But what's happened is that because the system's so deregulated, a great deal of the big increase in the international price of gas, so this gas is traded internationally. Norway sells the gas it produces into a world market. Lots of other countries do as well. And if you're Britain, you use more gas than you can produce out of the North Sea. So you have to buy an awful lot of gas from Norway, but also in liquefied from Qatar and a few other places. The price of that has gone up really quite a lot. And that means that because it's a very deregulated energy system, that price has fed in with a bit of profit added into people's bills quite rapidly. So there's meant to be a price cap that's in operation on this that was brought in a few years ago. That cap is being run, or has been run, by the regulator in a very sort of privatised, business friendly, it's actually friendly to the suppliers of gas so they can keep their profits, not friendly to households and most businesses. So the big increases that have come through this year have really, really squeezed people's budgets. So after that increase in April, this 56% increase in April, there was a few people who got together and basically, it was really not many, three or four people, launched a campaign online to get pledges that people would refuse to pay the increased price in gas come the next scheduled increase in October, which was forecast to be about 80% or so. So it's an absolutely catastrophic rise in the price of gas. You're talking a situation where, you know, last year the average household would be paying maybe £1,500, and it's now looking, or it was looking, at about £3,000 or something along these lines, a bit higher than that for the end of the year. So, and that really started to pick up. The campaign has been very, very impressive in terms of the amount of support it's been getting from people like, you know, sort of fairly well-known figures in Britain, like Martin Lewis, you know, people who sort of commentate and talk about consumer prices and that sort of thing. But also just it's developed very organically. So it's been online, it's been via Twitter, it's been via word of mouth. The last time I looked, I think they've got something around 170,000 people pledged to say they won't pay. It was clearly turning into a political concern, because in addition to the people who told the campaign "Don't Pay UK" that they wouldn't pay, there was, you could go off and do opinion polls and find that many millions of people saying they were either not going to pay, they couldn't pay, that it was going to be a serious problem for the gas business come the 1st of October with this big price increase. So what's happened since then is that the government that has changed somewhat, now that Liz Truss rather than Boris Johnson is Prime Minister, the very first thing she did shortly before it was announced that the Queen had died was to say that the government would cap the price of gas and spend, they thought, £150 billion for the next 2 years on trying to hold down the price of people's gas and energy bills in their homes. So that makes some difference. It's not a complete freeze on the price increase. It's also not taking prices back to where they were before. I mean, it's still a lot more than people are having to pay now. On average, I think bills are going up about £600 or so. So it's still a hefty increase. They're doing this because they're worried by the campaign. They have the industry yelling at them about the number of people who are threatening to cancel direct debits and all the rest of it. They're worried about the, actually just a risk of sort of social disorder, really, that you have so many people just breaking the law by not paying for something or possibly going out in the streets. It was quite a serious business there. So this is why they intervened, because you know, otherwise people would be in an utterly dire situation. And they're going to spend a great deal of money doing that. That was driven by the campaign and by the wider situation. This is not a government, and we can talk about this if you want, but this is not a government that is otherwise inclined to say, we'll be out to protect people, right? Their whole ideology, and that is the word to use, is free markets will determine what happens, and we will let free markets rip everywhere, and we will all, by some process, get to a better society as a result. So it's quite dramatic that they did this, but it's not necessarily enough. It's really not enough to end the crisis. My think tank did some research on this, and we think that probably the poorest households will still be spending about half of their disposable income on household energy, on heating their homes and electricity over the winter months. So it's still just this massive squeeze. So it hasn't ended that social crisis. It hasn't necessarily ended the political crisis. It's kind of shifted the terms of the debate a bit, because actually in some ways you can see this as a win for the movement, for what's happened, but it's not enough to actually end the problem.
But are they still going to not pay in October? Is the campaign like...
They are saying this, and I think we'll see what happens, because I think that although the government has made a big fuss about, oh, your bills won't go up, they're now capped, it's like the reality is the bills are arriving and they're up, right? And they're up a fair bit. Now, it's less than it would be, and okay, that's something, but it's still like really huge amounts of cash that you're going to have to pay. And so I suspect this is going to continue. It's maybe slightly more challenging now in some ways. Like, having got this sort of partial concession, it's a bit more challenging, I think, and there's a different argument about what's going to happen. I'll be interested to see what goes on with the day of action. Again, because the campaign has been organised not really through trade unions, not really through some of the traditional organisations, but much more online and fairly sort of spontaneous almost in parts of the country. It'll be interesting to see how many people actually turn out on streets and protest and make their presence known. It's a very large, significant number of signatures that they've got on the pledge. There have been moves also to set up local groups and to begin meeting locally. So there's a degree of more obvious coordination taking place. So we'll see what happens tomorrow.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. Unfortunately, our podcast is going to be out after that, but then we will link some information so people can read what happened. So central banks around the world are increasing interest rates in order to combat inflation right now. In Norway, we are seeing the Norwegian Confederation of Trade Unions, or the LO, I shall say from now on, are criticizing the central banks for raising the interest rates too much, arguing that high interest rates are likely to lead to rising unemployment. But the LO has also warned that many Norwegians have taken up huge mortgages that they won't be able to pay if the interest rates are increased so quickly, thereby creating a housing crisis, which will really be devastating for most people in this country. You've criticised the English central bank or the UK central bank along the same lines, pinning on your Twitter page, how to deal with inflation, raise wages, fix the price, so squeeze profits, which we thought was very interesting. We'd like to hear you say more about that. So what happened when interest rates are increased quickly and by a lot? Why shouldn't the bank increase their interest rates? And what kind of policy tools should the government and central bank be using instead?
Okay. So on the interest rate increases by central bank in Norway, central bank in Britain, the Bank of England, the European Central Bank, I mean, kind of everyone except all the big central banks other than the Bank of Japan are currently sort of looking at increasing interest rates. They're all acting in the same way for two reasons. One of them is that all of them have an idea of how you deal with inflation, which is that if inflation is picking up, and it is picking up everywhere, this means there is too much spending taking place in the economy. So if you like, people have a bit too much money. So what they need to do is make the price of getting more money, the price of borrowing money, more expensive, so that people will be less inclined to borrow money, less inclined to spend, more inclined to save, so they're not spending that money. And that way they kind of cool the economy down, they reduce demand. Now, what the LO says is absolutely right. What you're really saying at this point is you'd be happy with more unemployment. If there's less spending in the economy, that means businesses are selling fewer things, they start to make people redundant, they take fewer workers on, they don't employ people for the same number of hours. That increases unemployment. So they're right to say this. That is the mechanism that the central bank is trying to use. The problem that they have, and the reason that I just think this is nonsense with the kind of inflation that we have right now, is that what's driving up prices doesn't have anything to do with demand in a national economy like that. It's the opposite way around. What's driving up prices are really big external factors. So Russia invades Ukraine. This is a big whack on prices of gas, obviously, oil to some extent, food. You know, both countries, Russia and Ukraine, are major grain exporters. So that's a huge pressure on prices right the way across the globe for these things that are traded internationally. But that isn't going to be affected by, you know, the Bank of England putting up interest rates. It doesn't change whether Russia has invaded Ukraine. It doesn't make any difference from a British point of view to the price that you have to pay for gas you're buying from Qatar or Norway or whatever. The price has still gone up. So changing the interest rate really has limited impact on that kind of inflation. Might have some. So all you're really doing at this point is starting to increase the risk of significant unemployment. That's one part of it. The other part of it is, again, the yellow or right on this, is that, I mean, certainly in Britain, but actually across much of the world, US is in the same place, you have a lot of people who, over the last few years, because interest rates have actually been really quite low, have ended up with very big mortgages for very expensive houses. The house prices have in Britain gone absolutely crackers. Probably not quite so bad in Norway and across Europe in general, but we can talk about that. But it's a similar process everywhere. So there's big increase in house prices, big increase in the amount of mortgages people are having to take out to buy those very expensive houses, which means they're very, very sensitive to interest rate changes. If interest rates go up, you have a big mortgage that's now got an even bigger amount of interest you have to pay. So there's a real problem there. And the blowback from that could be very significant, that you'll find people perhaps unable to make their mortgage payments. They have repossessions. They're having to divert their spending into paying the mortgage rather than, you know, buying other things. So the risk of recession is increased. That's one of the things that can also start to kick in there. And as I said, none of this is very likely to work in terms of dealing with the inflation that we're seeing. Now, the other final bit in this is a slightly peculiar one, which is that probably seen maybe the krona less so, but the pound has been an absolute disaster for this, is that because the American Central Bank, the Federal Reserve, is starting to put up interest rates, the assets that you can buy in America, so it's property or financial assets or whatever, suddenly start to look really quite, they're paying a high rate of interest. And if you're trading internationally, if you're a financier who's doing this sort of thing, if you want one of the big financial institutions that moves money across the world looking for a high rate of return, the dollar assets suddenly look really, really promising. So the dollar goes up in price as well. And as the dollar goes up in price, every other country is forced down in relation to it. So the pound has really crashed, particularly in the last sort of week or so, relative to the dollar, relative to other currencies as well. That increases the pressure on central banks to try and keep up. That if they see the Federal Reserve doing this, they get dragged along behind it to also try and whack up interest rates. So that's one part of the issue there. There have been complaints about the Federal Reserve doing this. There's some pressure being applied to try and get it to stop. But from the Federal Reserve point of view, America also has inflation, so it also thinks it has to drive up interest rates and all the rest of it. So this is a mess, right? None of this looks good. And the more interest rates go up, and this is Yellow's exact point, basically, the more most people will suffer as a result. That's what happens. Like, you're either going to be made unemployed, or your wages are going to be reduced in real terms, or your mortgage is suddenly going to be a lot more expensive. Like, none of these things are good, and none of it is likely to deal with the inflationary pressures that we've now got.
So how could one deal with inflation? You have this 3-point, I don't know.
Tweet.
We'll
say 3-point
tweet. Where you say 1, raise wages, 2, fix prices, and so 3, squeeze profits. Yeah. How do you do that?
Well, this is the unspoken bit. You see a lot of mainstream commentary about the cost of living crisis and the rise in inflation. It's always about, you know, you get this story that actually wages are now going to go up and push prices up. If wages go up, employers will go, oh dear, I have to pay my workers more, therefore I need to put up prices for the goods I'm trying to sell. So this is the wage price spiral. This is the idea that what's really going to drive inflation, if we're not careful, maybe not right now, but at some point, is that wage rises are going to be so high that employers will have to put up prices to deal with the increased costs, and then maybe people demand higher wages and force employers to put up prices even more, and then just inflation goes out of control. That's the kind of story. It's a complete fantasy. It's a complete fantasy, and it's certainly in Britain, here I'd imagine it's the same across Europe and America, because, you know, inflation in Britain right now is about 9%. wages are going up 4%. So in real terms, in other words, after accounting for inflation, you're just being made poorer. Every pound you get is buying less and less over time. That's what inflation means. So people are being made poorer and poorer. There is no wage price spiral. There isn't some process where wages are going up so high that they push up inflation. What's actually happening here is something quite different. And if you think about it, economics can be quite simple sometimes. Is that, look, if prices of everything you have to buy, particularly some essential goods, but basically most things is going up, but your wages aren't, somebody else is taking the difference, right? So that's the profit, and that's the huge increase in profits that, well, gas companies, natural gas companies, suppliers of oil, some, you know, if you go and dig into supply, people who are selling grain, that all of these sort of essential goods that have gone up rapidly in price over the last sort of year or so, they're making really exceptionally high profits. And that's what's driving prices. That's the outcome of those high prices. So if you want to do something about this, you have... leave aside interest rates and this sort of thing, those profits are what you need to eat into to make sure most people can maintain their current standard of living. The profits have gone up over here, that you can squeeze. So you either say, well, let's put up wages, which is the obvious thing to do, or for some critical goods, things that are really essential to people, and natural gas is a really, really obvious one, you say, introduce a cap. So you say, okay, we're going to fix the cap because we're the government and we can make this happen. And then potentially you've got a cost that you might have to pay on top of that. Or you find some fairer way to make the tariff work for people. There's suggestions in Britain that, you know, you could entitle people to a certain amount of free energy and then pay a lot more for any you use on top of that, which would be a much fairer system because then everyone gets a basic allowance. And then if you've really got a massive house or something similar, you're going to pay a bit more on top. So that's something you can do where you're changing how the market operates. In Britain, if you want to put up wages, the obvious one is to increase the minimum wage really, you know, substantially. From it's about £10 an hour. The demand from trade unions is to get to £15 an hour, so it's 50% increase. Or you can fix prices of things people pay. But your aim is to see those profits and shrink them. It's not to say, okay, we're going to fiddle about with interest rates and maybe, you know, generate potentially really big profits for financial traders over here and do nothing about the profits that are already being made over there. It's a different approach to the problem.
When people are explaining the reasons for inflation, there are many reasons that are brought up, and often the one that you mentioned, the story about wages being too high and so on. You of course critique that, but you focused on climate change and environmental breakdown and the effects of that starting to make supply chains having problems. So that prices on essential goods and non-essential goods go up and drive inflation. Mm-hmm. Would you like to elaborate a bit on how that's going?
So this is the other part of the story, and it's the more fundamental one in some ways. That you know, the profits that are being made in some sectors you can kind of deal with. You could tax super profits if it's being made in gas companies and oil companies, if it's grain speculators, you can take that in tax. The more fundamental difficulty, and this is where the future starts to look quite bleak, is that we, you know, every day, pretty much every day, there's some story from somewhere in the world about an extreme weather event that's had some impact on how we can produce goods or how we can trade. Last week I saw a report from South Korea that I think it was a storm that knocked out a steel factory, so it can't make steel anymore. Last year there was a drought in Brazil which really walloped coffee production over there. There was a drought in Taiwan that knocked out semiconductor factories. It reduced their ability to produce semiconductors, the silicon chips, because they need a lot of water to do this. And then, you know, you might have seen over the summer extreme heat in Europe dried up the Rhine, so you couldn't move goods around so easily across Europe. Now, all of these things have an outcome which is similar in all cases, that they all result in things just becoming more expensive. It's harder to produce stuff. There's less stuff around. It's no longer that, you know, you've got as much coffees as you would want to sell to people. It's harder to produce it. And if it's harder to produce it and there's less stuff around, the price is going to go up. And that's that pressure on prices from, in particular, extreme weather events, which we know from what the climate scientists tell us, and actually you can just look at what's happened over the last sort of 20 years or so, is that we know these things are getting worse, more frequent over time and also bigger. Then you've got other things, you know, resource depletion, that you run out of, or you start to try and use more of really quite hard to get hold of materials. You want to decarbonize the economy, then okay, you need lots of lithium to put in the batteries for your electric cars and to back up your power supply systems, that sort of thing. Start to put all this together, it's a kind of a real resource pressure on the economy. Now, it's the consequences on climate change from 200 years of industrial capitalism, that we've been merrily pumping stuff into the atmosphere, we've been digging up anything we can burn or put into machinery, or just treating the world as we see fit. And it's the consequences coming back from that. And that is driving costs up all over the world. So the really big thing lurking behind inflation, it's not just that some companies are exploiting, actually, these shortages. That's what happens if you're selling oil and oil goes up in price. You're just exploiting that fact. You're not necessarily making better oil, right? You're not doing something clever that justifies the increase in price. You're just exploiting it. So it's not just the companies exploiting it. It's also changes in how our world is that is making life harder for people. So then you have to have an argument about, well, what do you do to make life easier for people? How do you cope with this? And again, I think we're back into part of that story about, look, a really quick and easy way to do this is try and pay people more so that they can cope with these price rises. So lean on the people at the top who own the companies that are making super profits. So tax them or change the ownership. You bring companies into forms of public ownership, for instance. You can shift the balance there and start saying, okay, you can pay most people more in order that they can cope with a world that starts to look much more unstable, where you have these super profits in parts of the system being generated, but most people are just experiencing a real squeeze on their living standards.
Yeah, I mean, the pandemic years that we just put behind us has really shown how most people's wages have gone down, or just we have lost parts of the public goods, or society hasn't really felt like it's going forward or become better. And then we see some huge companies getting so much more money and some people becoming so much richer. So that is just obvious that there is money that we can have in wages or for public goods that is somewhere else, like you said before. So during the lockdown, Daniel convinced all his friends to read Kim Stanley Robinson's book, The Ministry for the Future. And I did, and I really liked it. But I think, Daniel, you found it particularly relevant than most of us, so you get very excited. Can you tell us about why you thought that was so good?
Yeah, I think the reason I liked it so much was that it kind of presents a vision for the future where things turn out okay, because it's basically about climate change over the next 60, 70 years. And it starts at a really bad place with a huge climate catastrophe in India that kills 20 million people. And then it ends in 2060, 2070, and things are kind of like starting to work out. But still, it's not an utopian novel, because the future it envisions is not perfect. And there's a lot of terrible stuff happening on the way, a lot of violence, a lot of natural disasters, and so on. Kim Stanley Robinson himself talks about the book as an anti-dystopia. But I was really inspired by the book, because we lack visions of the future that kind of tell a story about life becoming better, because it also does in some ways in the book. You should read it. And I think the thing, having visions about a better future is like really important for the left. And I think it's really been lacking, at least on the Norwegian left, for the past decades, because very much of left politics is about fighting back against deregulation, fighting back against neoliberalism. So Corbyn's Labour, like when Corbyn was in charge of Labour championed quite a few radical policies for changing the ownership structure of the economy, like policies for how we businesses could be owned by or these parts of businesses could in the future be owned by those who work in them, basically another form of ownership. Would you talk a bit about that? and what we can do to like democratize the economy and how that could point towards like a better future, be something to like mobilize around.
So many people have recommended Kim Stanley Robinson to me. I haven't actually read the book yet, but I really need to get around to it. And I think that's quite important from your description and other people's description. It doesn't doing the useful work of thinking about what a plausible future looks like. Because I think one of the things, not just the Norwegian left, it's been a problem on the English left, on the British left, that there's a sort of failure of imagination. That you end up, if you want to talk about what the future might be like, you end up sort of pointing at something in the past. Yeah, the golden age of capitalism, 50s and 60s, when there was high growth and full employment and a welfare state that worked and this sort of thing. It's a sort of slightly mythologized view of this whole period. You point at that and you say, we could have that. And it's like the really big problem I have with that now. There are many problems. I think first of all, if you say you're on the left and you're going to be the progressives and you've got the ideas for the future, you need to actually have an idea for the future. Just inherently, you need to be kind of forward looking. It's no good having a left that's sort of wallowing in nostalgia in various forms. But the other bit here is that look, if we're now in a world that's very unstable environmentally, that if climate change is real, it is. The world is getting warmer and more unstable. We are not going back to the conditions of the 1950s and 1960s. It's gone. Right? The world has irrevocably changed as a result of the damage we've inflicted on it over a long period of time. So we just have to deal with that and come up with ways that we can adapt to this rather than fantasizing about wouldn't it be nice if we could get the point back to some place where all the problems seem less complicated. And I think there's that unwillingness to think about what are the complicated problems, how do we deal with them, because climate change is happening and it's going to disrupt everything. It is disrupting everything we do, and it's going to be horrible, and it's going to get worse from here. This is a pretty bleak sort of view, but it's the one that's scientifically informed about where we are right now. So you either deal with this and you say, this is how it's going to be in the future, or you can continue to fantasize. I sometimes put it as it's no longer about thinking about what the ideal future might be. You're not going to get that. It's about thinking about what a life raft might look like and how you build one, how you deal with the crisis. So books that say, okay, things are objectively bad and they're going to get worse, how can we adapt to this in a fair way? How can we make sure that things that we appreciate as people are still there and that we can maintain and support and even grow some of this stuff? So that's where I think it's quite useful. On the alternative models of ownership work, as we called it. So this is a whole load of policy work we did with Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonnell when he was Shadow Chancellor from 2015 onwards, that was trying to get into the sets of questions about the very odd way we allow things in our society, particularly public goods of various sorts, in other words, things that we all benefit from, to be owned and monopolised because of that ownership. So we have allowed in Britain this big neoliberal sweep to take place in the last 40 years where most stuff is privatised. It's taken, you have things that are essential to how people live, like natural gas, like the energy systems that we use, so electricity, water. They're taken and then sold off in some form to private companies. And these private companies then look to make a profit and often do so in really like peculiar financialized ways that rely very heavily on sort of financial wheeler dealing and taking out big debts and all sorts of stuff. It's a system that doesn't work very well. You end up with water companies that are, just over the last few months, you find that most of the beaches in the country are now not up to the usual European standard for sewage. They're just dumping raw sewage into our rivers and onto the seas because they don't have the incentive not to do this. They're profit-making companies. This is how they end up behaving. So it's a really sort of damaging, stupid way to run the essentials of life. And what we were trying to do with the work you talked about was also think, well, okay, how do we also change ownership across other parts of the economy? So how do we change how big companies are owned so they're not just purely exploitative? How do we transfer ownership back to workers? How do we re-envision the economy as not something where basically a very few people own really pretty much everything, right? That's the actual distribution of wealth is incredibly skewed towards those at the top and not towards those in the rest of society. How do you redistribute that? How do you make the economy something that we've all got more of a stake in, more of a say over, more democratic control over, something that people would feel attached to and part of in a way that right now we don't have? Ideally, you get rid of problems like these super profits for various private monopoly producers of essential goods. You'd stop having in Britain a few very large companies dominating some of the sectors of the economy, essentially because they're so dominant they're able to underpay their workers. You'd shift the ownership, you'd shift their incentives as a company and how they do that. So that was the sort of practical bit of what would a plausible future look like. It was trying to put together some of that stuff.
On the same note, like, how can we deal with what is coming? We see many different crises at the same time.
Yep.
Socially, financially, ecologically. And often we also see that many groups are put up against each other in order to not deal with all this crisis. And of course, we have to deal with the fact that we need another society and we kind of need it quick. What can we do to make the just transition for all?
Well, it's a really good question, because there's a slight, there can be a belief, if you're on the left, that climate change leads you inherently towards nice sort of progressive, socially just solutions. So you go, okay, we'll have a Green New Deal and this will sort out climate change. And that's jobs for people, but jobs doing nice green things. And who wouldn't want that? And I think there's two problems with this. One is that isn't a conclusion necessarily from climate change. That if you look at National Rally, the old National Front in France, and the way that they in particular will talk about climate change and the environment as something that is a problem for France, and that it has to be dealt with by a strong French state, and that actually the real issue with climate change is that we're going to get all these migrants and refugees, and therefore we need to build strong borders. And borders, this is their line, borders are the environment's best friend. So it's overtly sort of racist and divisive and deliberately using climate change in that way as a sort of part of their rhetoric and part of what they want to do about it. So it's no longer climate change denial, right? That's something that you used to see. It's accepting it's happening and then racializing it, right, in quite a stark fashion. You also, I think, it's nothing like the same sort of political problem. I mean, just to be clear, the National Rally are quite an exceptional challenge to that extent. But there's a degree of that when you start talking about the Green New Deal. That there's a danger that versions of the Green New Deal say things like, okay, well, we need to stop all our cars being petrol and diesel driven, switch them all over to electric, and then once we've done that, we've like decarbonised very rapidly and this will be good. The issue there is that if you start seriously switching every car around currently with an internal combustion engine to electric, that is a huge demand with the technologies we have for batteries. If you're making batteries, you need lots of fairly obscure rare earth minerals. Lithium is one of them. And that means you have to go to places and dig those materials up and then put them in the batteries and then sell the cars. Now, who's going to be doing the digging? How much are they going to get paid? Because if you're a lithium miner in Bolivia or somewhere, that's not good conditions. It's not good for you to be doing that. And then, of course, there's some very beautiful unspoiled parts of the world, like Greenland, which is reckoned to be a huge depository of these rare earth minerals. The challenge is, if you're saying in a relatively rich developed country, Norway or relatively rich Britain, that everyone can switch into electric vehicles, you have all this backwash of impacts that are happening elsewhere in the world that you're pushing off somewhere. So there's a real difficulty, I think, in thinking about climate change in a way that tries to knit all these things up. On the one hand, it's taking on what I think is going to become the more common, basically racist arguments about all of these climate refugees mean we need higher borders, that's how we're going to deal with it. So it's a sort of racist or racialized adaptation. The other part of it is, if we get too concerned or too much into a purely sort of technocratic, in other words, technology-driven solution to this, like switch all the cars to electric vehicles, you end up with this great sort of backwash of problems appearing elsewhere in the world, that you're digging up Greenland, that you're exploiting lithium miners in South America. These are all like, we have to think about how you deal with that entire package of problems rather than just think, we've got the one solution here.
That is very much the thing that's happening here in the country. Like, electric cars is one of the main solutions for climate change, and not stopping the oil production, of course. Yeah. That would be scandalous and not the right way to go about anything. We see that doing change in climate matter that would actually change society and how things work, it's very much not on the table. And it's the suggestions that, as a leftist and also as an environmentalist, that is for a more sustainable and just transition, collective solutions, mm-hmm. changing the way a 6 hours workday. Yeah. I mean, that will be a great change. All these kind of things that will make our life better and that will move us away from a more capitalist and neoliberal society are just... when you're trying to talk about the six-hour workday, it's really not just it's not happening, and the discussions are not there, even on the left parties, and also big environmental organizations don't want to talk about these things. So the linking of a different economic system and the environment, but also a more sustainable in the social way societies. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's coming up at the agenda now. I think like it's forced on the agenda, but it's not really been an easy link in a country, oil-producing country like Norway. How can you see those kind of just transition being popularized in the UK right now?
Well, I think some of this is starting to happen already. The win that we need to be looking for, the way that we're going to convince people about this, is because there are kind of several bad versions of what does a transition to a sort of decarbonized or less environmentally damaging future look like? One of them is everything will basically be the same, but zero carbon, right? So everything just carries on it is, but we'll flick a switch and change your car to an electric car. But you'll carry on working for 8 hours a day and you'll carry on with everything else exactly as it was in the past. So that's one bad version of it. And I think the idea that you raised, which is reductions in working time, looks like a really exceptionally good way to try and get there. Because first of all, it's popular. Like, for obvious reasons, if you say to people, would you like to work less but have the same amount of pay? Like, there aren't many people who say, no, I don't want to take that offer. So you can make it quite popular and you can make it plausible. There's a very, very good, some very impressive work being done in Britain now on pilot studies of companies introducing four-day weeks and the impact that has on their productivity, on, you know, how do their staff feel about their work, how happy they are, mental health, this sort of thing. The earlier results are all very encouraging. Yeah, so it's people like working like this. They are more productive. You can get that win-win out of this thing. And, of course, the ecological impacts tend to be really good. Like, you don't have people commuting so much. And fairly clearly you're using less energy if you're going to be in your home more often than you're trying to drive to work or whatever. So the ecological impact is quite clear, but it's a shift. It's a social shift in how we operate and how we act. And there are things that follow from this. If you have people working less, there's going to be more demand for things for them to do because they're not in work. So at that point you think, okay, well, how do we then reshape our public spaces so they're genuinely public? Why don't we have more public parks, which is a good environmental benefit? Why don't we open more libraries? Why don't we have more shared spaces for us to use now that we have more free time? And we can do that in ways that are not so ecologically damaging as a kind of very high rate of work, high rate of consumption sort of model of doing this. Now, the challenge, I think, is to get all that together without it sounding like some slightly hippie version of the world where, you know, you put on your hair shirt and appreciate the fact that you're working less. I think there's a way to do this. I think the route to doing this is back to that question of redistribution. That if we're saying to people, you can maintain a standard of living that is basically the same or better, but how you consume, how you live is going to be different and it's going to be better. You can make that work if we're prepared to also say, to make this work, we're going to have to redistribute from the top of society. We're going to find the top 1% or even the top 0.1% and take some of their wealth and use it to make sure everybody has a better standard of living than they have now, but in a slightly different way, that they're consuming differently. And that, I think, is the two bits that need to come together. So it's a very traditional labour movement concern, left concern with redistribution, matched up to what would a new society look like if we were taking a, the English word is holistic approach, like a completely rounded view of all the things that need to happen to make the just transition work.
Yeah, I mean, our last question was going to be, what is the way forward for the left? But I guess you just answered that.
Yeah, I hope so. I think that there is something to this. I think the question of redistribution, in Britain, I think the question of redistribution is now going to be very, very central because, bluntly, I think the economy's not in a very good state at all. The pound is going to continue to fall in value. The government is borrowing a huge amount of money. It's not very productive. It's a low investment society. It's a low wage society. But it does have quite a lot of rich people in it. So there's at least some sort of basis for thinking you can reconstruct things. So the question of redistribution, I think, is going to be key over the next few years.
How do you see the next years, the years ahead? Because the Conservative government is probably going to sit for at least 2 to 3 years.
Just two, I'd imagine. I don't see them winning the next election, so 2 years.
Yeah. Do you think, but Labour that would then win, do you think there's any prospects for the kind of policies we need getting on the table?
This is going to be the hard argument, because I think, assuming Labour does win, which at the minute seems likely, I mean, they're on 33 points ahead of the Conservative Party in the opinion polls, they'll inherit a very, very bad and worsening situation. And the argument that will be presented will be, that means we have to cut back on our ambitions. That means that potentially we have to impose spending cuts, that we have to try and repay this huge debt. And there's all these other arguments that come through. The only way, I think, to get through those is to push for this point about redistribution, that we're going to have to introduce a proper wealth tax in Britain to start to deal with the gross inequalities that are built up over the last few years. If we can do that, then there's the potential to also get the scale of the ambition that is needed. Otherwise, what I think will happen is that there were some nice announcements at Labour conference last week. The party has just had its conference, and some nice things, sort of Green New Deal type, you know, a few decent things coming through there. They will get up to the election and it will just be, we can't afford any of this. This is impossible. We're not going to redistribute from the rich. That's things that are now off the table. And then they win and then nothing happens. Then everything just carries on as it always does. So that, I think, is the absolutely crucial argument in Britain for the next 2 years. Redistribution, wealth taxes, higher taxes on the rich. That's how we're going to pay for this stuff.
I think we can see a definite parallel to the Norwegian movements and also what we need here. Thank you very much for coming and talking to us. Thank you, Daniel, also.
No problem. Thank you.
For talking to this podcast. Unfortunately, this episode will be released a bit later this fall. We are very happy that we got to talk to you guys and have such an interesting conversation.
Du har hørt podcasten Fra krise til håp fra Norges sosiale forum. Du spørsmål til denne episoden, kan du sende til podcast@globalisering.no. Flere episoder hører du der du hører podcast.